We begin in the name of the source of life, the source of consciousness, the source of love, the creative power that brought us here and to which we return. And in Sufism, there is a phrase, a very important phrase in the traditional language, which is Sehri Suluk. I don't know how to translate it. It's kind of a redundant term, it seems. It's something like the journey of the journey, the stages of the journey, let's say. And this refers to the conscious journey of the dervish, the seeker, who has committed herself or himself to the initiatic path and has come under the mentoring, the guidance, the protection of a teacher and a lineage. So the dervishes refer to Sehri Suluk to describe this whole education. And there is a recognition that there is a completion, a relative completion to this suluk. Not that everyone completes it, but there is at least an ideal of completion. And while teachers may differ a little as to what that is, there is nevertheless this recognition that there is a process for maturing the human being into God realization and into full human maturity. And this is the meaning of Sehri Suluk. And this is what I'm going to attempt to talk about today and to give us an experience of. I'd like to first begin with experience and invite you all to participate in a small part of the ceremony of the whirling dervishes. The ceremony of the whirling dervishes begins with a procession around the sacred space. And this procession reenacts and symbolizes the journey of life on earth. It also symbolizes the journey of manifestation from the unseen to the seen and the return again. And in a way, it's preparation for the whirling, the four stages of the whirling ceremony. So the way we're going to do this is we're going to step over here into this space, and we're going to form a circle with everyone equidistant. And this is a gentle process, but if anyone feels that they would rather sit it out, that's fine too. But I encourage you, if you're physically able, to participate in this, because it is something about the unity of us here together. That is the important aspect of this. So, if you will, and it's best to, if you have shoes on, to take them off. And this quality of presence that we have created together, sustain it. The journey. Sehri Suluk, the path of initiation, the inevitable journey we all need to make, willingly or unwillingly, because everything in creation is returning, willingly or unwillingly. With us, God willing, willingly. There is a term, I'm sure you all know it, murid. Murshid guides the murid, is the one who is willing. Yes, Joe. How's the microphone? We're not hearing it. Can we have a little bit more volume? The murid is the one willing to go on this journey. But higher stage, well, we'll get to that later. Remember murid, we'll come back to it. I'm going to share with us a map of the journey. I'm going to touch on the seven stages and talk about some of the practices and obstacles of those stages. But before I do, I'd like to tell you a story, read you a story. The story is partly from traditional sources to whom we owe a very clear debt. It also has been slightly revised for our own purposes today. It was published originally in a book called Living Presence. And it's called The City of Separation, A Tale of Transformation. There was a city covered by clouds. In it were huge buildings, schools, factories, malls. The city was a place where raw materials, both physical and human, flowed. It was the center of the economy. It was where you had to be an important, successful person. But it was also a place where many terrible things happened. The majority of people, in their own estimation, were failures. No person or place was secure from crime. And the conditions supported in this environment produced a wide variety of illnesses, including some that were deadly and contagious. The city was very dark. Energy had become scarce, and little light was available. People passed one another in shadows and couldn't easily see one another. Perhaps to be noticed more easily, they improvised various extreme forms of dress and behavior. In this place, it was typical for people to live in fear and even suspicion. Even so-called friends withheld much from each other. If you asked who was in charge of this place, you would certainly be told, "But we are all free here. We follow our own selves. No one controls us." For a long time, I had found this city interesting. I was drawn to walking its dark streets at all hours. I wished to be an observer. But increasingly, I found that I was becoming part of it all. How often had I said I would leave, but something always came up to delay my departure, a job promotion, an affair, or even an illness. But eventually I began to wish to find a different life or change something inside myself. But as often as I thought about it, nothing ever changed. I once asked a friend, "Am I the only one who feels that something isn't quite right? Does anybody else feel this way?" "Sure, we all complain," he answered. "But this is life. We have to adjust to reality. but there are good people here. In fact, there's a neighborhood of this city I'd like you to know. You'll find there are many people who feel the way you do. So I was informed of the neighborhood of remorse, as it was called, and came to know the people there. They were in most respects like the other people in the city, except that they felt remorse over some of their actions. Among the population were many arrogant, envious, and insincere individuals who took pleasure in getting the upper hand in every situation. I came to know them well, their selfishness and doubt, their obsessions and hesitations, their remorse, their inevitable acceptance of their weakness. I was one of them. I asked, why don't people change? Why do they always think about it, talk about it, but never do it? Do we ever think of where all this leads? By some chance, a few of the people of this neighborhood had found a way out. They had come to know a place called the Village of Sharing. Whether they found it by accident or through their own desperation, they were led to this town over which a sign reads, "Spirit within us all." And this village was the home of someone named Miss Affection. The people here enjoyed many forms of togetherness. They had many occasions for celebration, and they sang songs together and danced. Their children were respected and allowed plenty of playtime, and they were also given useful work. Travelers and guests were also welcomed and cared for. Family members did not fear getting old and useless. When one of them might fall sick, others took this as a special opportunity to pay a visit. Married people did not fear judgment or abandonment. Lovers were guiltless and pure. Each person valued his or her own work because of how it fit into the whole. And everyone had something to work at because all were needed by the others. But more than anything, what kept them happy was the totally irrational and immeasurable love that they felt for Miss Affection. Once people had met her, there was little chance of them ever returning to the city of darkness. Unlike the people of that city who acted solely and predictably from their own self-interest, these people of the Village of Sharing were less predictable. They even acted irrationally, giving away the best they had and expecting nothing in return. These people seemed to live almost in a mist of love. They would not have survived well in most other places, but here in Sharing, one found the rich and the poor, the strong and the weak living happily together. Those who were educated were humbly teaching those who wished to know more. Those who served respected those who were served, and vice versa. Here, one felt relaxed, at home, even joyous. My life went smoothly along for some time, but eventually, I began to feel something unsettled in my heart. When I saw a certain old man whose face was radiant with life and compassion, I asked him, "Maybe you can help me. I cannot seem to remember what it is I really want." He paused for some minutes, looked deeply into my eyes, and asked, "What do you love?" "Well," I said, "when I was in the city, I had forgotten about love. When I came to this village, I realized that there was nothing I wanted more than to be with these people. But now I'm not sure. Beyond this village, my son, is a place you might visit. Don't worry, I can easily take you there. And in this place you may meet, God willing, four kinds of people. First, there are the pretenders. You will see them reading and talking about the truth, even doing the postures of meditation and the forms of worship, but their minds are often somewhere else. And yet, they are practicing the ways of love, the fruits of love, as if they really knew love. And this alone, will save them in the end. They are learning that the One has many names. May their imitation become reality. Then, there are the warriors. They practice the greater work, the struggle with the self. They are quiet and gentle, thankful and courteous. The activities they love are the simple acts of living, prayer and spontaneous service. They have shed the artificialities of the ego and its many distractions. Their egos have been tamed by love. They have found submission. They have learned to serve their innermost heart. If you ever find them, stay with them long enough to learn patience and real contentment. Third, you may meet, God willing, the people of remembrance. They remember the One inwardly in all that they do. They eat little, sleep little, and speak little, lest they distract one another's attention from the presence of the One. They are the easiest people to be with, light as feathers, never a burden on anyone. If you spend many years with them, God willing, you might even overcome your forgetfulness, doubt, and withholding. But even when you do, you will still have the hidden contradiction within yourself, the contradiction of I and He. At this moment, I was overcome with such sadness that the tears were flowing before I knew it. I wanted to drown in a sea of sorrow because I felt so far from anything real, so lost. But the sight of the radiant face of my old friend took away my sense of hopelessness. "Oh, dear one," he said, "slave of your own ego, orphan, exile, beggar. The fourth group you will meet, God willing, are the people of total submission. They are speechless. They undertake no unnecessary action on their own, but there is no obstacle to the will of their greater self. No hesitation, no second thoughts, no bargaining. They have reached the most subtle state of themselves and know their own nothingness. These people ask nothing for themselves, because they are identified with the creative power itself. You may live among them for many years until you know of their state, and your actions appear as theirs. But you will not be inwardly one of them if you still suffer from separation, if you still are yourself, if you still feel lover and beloved, if your experience still comes from the well of your own subconscious, by your own inner faculties, as long as a trace of you remains in you, you have not attained your purpose. Know that there is a knowledge and a certainty that comes through spirit alone. Spirit plus nothing. That is your highest destiny. So, back to Earth, back to our lives, our world. The Sufis have described this journey sometimes in three stages, I believe, as Pir Zia did so eloquently the other morning. Sometimes in seven stages. There's no contradiction between these. But I'd like to talk a little bit about the seven stages to give an overview. The very first stage, and by the way, every stage is a stage of the self. It is a quality or a mode of selfness. You know, on this whole journey, we are always working with one thing, which is self, nafs. Nafs in Arabic means ego, egoism. It means self. It also means soul. But picture it like a ladder of ascent. At the lowest level, the experience of self, which is called a nafs al-amara, the commanding or compulsive self, our experience of identity is an experience of slavery to our own whims and desires. It's like a prison of compulsions. It is like hard ice. The later stages of self, which we'll travel through, are stages of increasing refinement and subtlety of that experience of self. But always, what we are working with is an experience of self in ever greater and finer and subtler dimensions. So this talk about losing self or annihilating the self is a little misleading. Misleading because the self that is annihilated, well, we begin with annihilating our own slavery. That would be a good place to start. One of my first teachers said, he defined dervish as the one who stands at the threshold between slavery and freedom. And we recognize in this tradition that our nafs has certain rights. The point, despite this very perhaps awesome, if not intimidating, tale I just read you, the nafs, our own self, has certain rights. The point is not to crush every desire of the self, but to bring those desires into an appropriate form and expression, and to not be enslaved, this is the key point, to not be enslaved to anything in us that would cause harm to others or to ourselves. So this nafs amara, the self of compulsions, you all know it. We all live in this state. This is part of our reality. Even if we have a center of gravity at a higher level, in some respects we are all, we have our triggers, shall we say. That which triggers the nafsiyamara, for some it may be power, for some it may be money, for some it may be status, for some it may be sex. We all have those things. But in the spiritual path, we are taking steps to overcome the slavery to these things. And the very first level above this nafsiyamara is the nafs alawama, the blaming self, the self that begins to have a perspective on these desires and begins to observe and witness and have some remorse, have some regret, like the people in the neighborhood of remorse in this story. We may have the remorse, we may not even be able to do anything about some of these things, but at least we're beginning to see them and observe them. Sufis work with, at this level, the level of repentance, which is turning ourselves again toward God, with the name Astaghfirullah. Almost all the zikr practices begin with Astaghfirullah. It's like the shower we take before we put on the perfume of zikr, remembrance of God. So, Astaghfirullah, which means may God forgive me, is not a invoking of shame upon ourselves. We are already in enough shame, particularly as a culture. This culture is infested with shame. The sad thing is that we don't know fully enough. We don't have a relationship to the divine being who is the one who loves to forgive. There is a hadith Qudsi that says, Allah says, if the human race were to stop sinning completely, I would need to create another humanity that would sin in order that I might forgive them. So, we were created as we are. We were created with the contradictions and the complexes of desires and ignorance that we all know and experience. But this serves its a purpose within the overall ecology of the spiritual life, because it compels us to seek mercy, compels us to humble ourselves and to ask for help. When Rumi's teacher Shams was teaching him, he said, there is the Qadim, the ancient one, who has existed from before time. And here we are, all of those beings who have been created in time, so to speak. And the ancient one has a great palace. And this is a palace that has no needs. There's nothing, there's no lack in this palace of the ancient one. And sometimes we human beings boldly and heroically say, I'll cut off my head and I'll bring it as an offering to the palace of the ancient one. I'll annihilate myself, I'll bring my head to the palace of the ancient one. And the ancient one kindly laughs, because he is the creator of all heads in the first place. And Shem says, it's like bringing your cumin seed to Kirman, which is the source of all cumin seeds. What good will it do anybody? But bring to that palace something that's not there. So what can you bring that is not in that palace? And Shems of Tabriz tells us, bring your need before God, so that God may have the pleasure of fulfilling your need. And this was the truth that got Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi burning for the rest of his life, when he realized the generosity of God, when he realized that this universe is for answering needs. But what kind of needs? Mevlana also tells us, don't be like a little nibbling mouse with your needs. Don't have trivial needs. Have a great need, so that God might fulfill a noble need in you. Don't just be a mouse nibbler of need. Don't ask for, you know, the small material things or the small ego things, but awaken your yearning. Awaken a yearning that's worthy of a human being. In our tradition, sin is not a sin against God. Sin is the violation or corruption of our own humanness, of our own human nature. We can't hurt God, but we can hurt ourselves. So what sin is in the Sufi tradition and in the Quran and in the Hadith of the Prophet, sin is that which diminishes our human nature. And spirituality is that which fulfills our human nature. So this sort of reframes the whole issue. So the second level is the level of coming to know that there is a power of forgiveness in the universe that can transform our shame and help us to know that we are loved. Forgive us, O you who love to forgive. But of course, there needs to be repentance to merit that forgiveness. So now some work begins. We attempt to awaken, first of all, simply awaken from our numbed, mechanical, habitual, desensitized state, which unfortunately is becoming more and more epidemic in this particular culture, in this world, which is so mechanized, so technology dominated, that all of the things that formerly brought us in touch with animals, with nature, with each other, seem to have been pushed to the background, and we spend our time, at least I do, a lot of time in front of a computer screen, God help me. We need to return to our humanness. We need to awaken our sensitivity, our noticing that we are alive, our awareness that we are embodied. This too is a spiritual step, to simply sense that we are here in a physical body, breathing, alive, with senses operating. This already begins to awaken the ruh, the spirit, in the human being, which is the whole key. If you want a key, this is the whole key. We have in our being, at the heart of our being, we have this, what is called ruh, it means spirit. It is the witnessing power. It is the almost impersonal pole of our being, which can witness. Ruh, spirit, witnesses nafs, or self, and forms a relationship with it. And when that relationship is a proper relationship, through the mediation of the heart, in other words, the heart connects spirit and self, from the witnessing core of our own being, we have a relationship with our self, and we can begin to do the work on the self. But unfortunately, the common condition for humanity is a reverse polarity, where the nafs, the ego, is empowered, and the ruh has shrunk back, has disappeared from sight, and the tyranny of the nafsi amara rules our lives. We are enslaved to that tyranny, and that spiritual core of our being is asleep or obscured or veiled. So the Sufis teach, and here's another principle, because I'm here to share maybe the kernels of knowledge, the essential, the most essential gems of knowledge and realization that I personally have grasped, to share that knowledge as something we may take with us and remember, not just to share a state, a high or intoxicated state. We could do that. It's nice to do that. We will do that. And we prepared ourselves with the Peshrev to even be able to hear certain things. We had to come to a certain hall or state to even begin to speak about things. But to be increased in knowledge is a great pleasure and a necessity on the spiritual journey. Some understanding will take us a long way. So the Sufis say again and again, you have to awaken heart in order to have a connection between self and spirit. Otherwise, the spirit is so out there, or in there in reality, so in there, that we don't have that bridge, we don't have that common ground. And the heart, according to Ibn Arabi, according to Mevlana, according to the basic Sufi psychology and metaphysics, the heart, awakened heart, that sense of inner spaciousness, that sense of, you might say, the best of our sub and superconscious faculties that help to connect the conscious self to the infinite, that's what we mean by the heart, the sub and superconscious faculties that can connect us to the infinite, that has to be awakened, realized, awakened, and eventually purified. And one essential definition of tasawuf, or Sufism, is simply this: the science of the purification of the heart. Rumi says in a poem, a rich man dies and goes before God, and he's dragged with him 50 sacks of gold. And God says, what's this? Bring me the heart. Bring me your heart. Show me your heart. I don't care about all this other stuff. Bring me your heart. If your heart is pleased with you, I am pleased with you. Your relationship to your heart is my relationship to you. The Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him, was asked, what is evil? The Prophet said, evil is whatever troubles your heart, leave it. So, Sufism is the purification of the heart. This leads us into stage 3. An-nafs al-mulhama, which means the inspired self, the self which is inspired, not fully enlightened, but inspired as to the realization of what is positive and negative, what is right and wrong, what is healthy and what is not healthy for us, for our souls. An-nafs al-mulhama. My sheikh taught me to look for 3 things in my heart and to keep my heart free of 3 things: envy, resentment, and pride. Envy is not necessarily wanting what somebody else has. It can be that. I mean, actually, if I see a person who has humility, I should be envious of that humility. There's a positive envy. But the negative envy is wishing that that person would not be humble, that they would stumble in pride. That is envy. Envy is wanting people to lose what they have, wanting them not to have what they have, because I don't have it. So I don't want you to have it. I don't, you know, jealousy over spiritual states, jealousy over, I mean, this is very interesting. You know, why have the saints and prophets been persecuted? For their goodness. Why is the sacred most likely to be that which is violated? It comes from this tendency, this poisonous tendency in ourselves of envy. Resentment. Resentment being that sort of low level, almost unconscious, usually unconscious, anger. Which may be towards a person, a situation, and maybe towards existence itself. There is no spiritual attainment for an individual or a group that becomes a house of resentment. For every spiritual guide with who has responsibility for other people, the house cleaning of all resentment, the teaching of those principles that help us to clean our house, the house of our hearts, of all resentment, is what is absolutely necessary to worship God in a true and sincere way, and to receive the grace that comes when a group of people turn their attention in worship, in love, toward our source. Pride, of course, again, there's a positive pride and there's a negative pride. What I'll say about pride is that the remedy for this pride, a remedy that comes to my mind, is the remembrance that all good, all power, all beauty comes from God. That any of our own attributes that are positive attributes, our patience, our humility, if we should have any, our forgiveness, our generosity, these are gifts that come from God through us and are manifesting through us. For us to claim them is the subtle pride that has to be guarded against. There are much cruder forms of pride, but let's reflect on this subtler pride, which is the ego's tendency to claim something for itself. The greatest lesson that I have learned from Sufism, if I dare to say something like this, is the realization that God, and not me, is the center of the universe. It seems obvious when I put it that way, but in terms of the realities of our own psychology, how often does the average person, especially in this culture, put the divine reality at the center? We're helped by certain phrases in our tradition, certain phrases like Allahu Akbar, God is greater than everything, or Alhamdulillah, something happens, we say thanks, it doesn't matter what language you use. Thanks be to God. All praise is God's, all power is God's. Always referring back to that one reality, that one awesome reality which we serve, upon which we utterly depend. This is the remedy, a remedy for our pride. We have some attitudes to overcome in the process of Sufi education. I want to read, because I will forget some details, a page and a half of that I wrote that has not been published, but it's also here, and I'm reading it especially because I know there are teachers in this listening here. And I want you all, but especially those of you in leadership of any kind in the Sufi process, I want to share this with you. It's called What Adulterates the Sufi Process. The process of Sufism is for those who have the capacity to develop and who are free from those qualities that would adulterate the learning process. The Sufi learning situation should, among other things, free the seeker from trivialities which would obscure the learning process. When we hear of people talking about my truth, finding it in myself, the formless path, it is almost always an expression of the frivolity of the ego, unfortunately unrecognized by us speaking these words. Whirling dervishes aside, Sufism is not possible for those caught by the need to spin only on their own axis. Sufism requires a characteristic or appropriate institution to accomplish its tasks and to avoid its degeneration into a mere sociological grouping. The Sufi education cannot be standardized, marketed, franchised, because it is not a process of indoctrination or conditioning. Beware of the person who has had a mere glimpse of higher reality and feels compelled to teach it. There is a characteristic American notion that we should be able to learn what we want, when we want it, in the way we'd like to learn it. Such expectations adulterate the capacity to learn. A seeker needs to be willing to follow a path, a curriculum, without mixing different paths according to his or her own liking, and thus producing a possibly unbalanced or unhealthy process. Many people come to the spiritual path with disguised needs for personal gratification. One of the most common situations involves the need for attention. Some people even thrive on conflict and agitation, securing by these means the attention, which is their fundamental goal and need. Every human being has a minimum need for attention, which should be satisfied in one's everyday life before approaching the spiritual path. Otherwise, this unconscious need adulterates the learning process itself. In general, our basic emotional needs need to be filled, but they should be filled prior to and not exclusively through the spiritual path. Only then is there the quality of receptivity needed for the higher learning situation. Some people come to the spiritual path seeking what they imagine is ecstasy or intoxication. Exercises produce energies, but without a balanced prior education, these same energies, while they may make the good better, may also make the bad worse. The narcissistic personality might delight in certain Sufi environments, but a capable teacher will root out this narcissism and emotional dependency. Sufism should not be based on the wielding of power on either side of the relationship. It is an agreement entered into by mature people. We must be willing to come with both hands open, and also be willing to stretch. People are often willing to make big changes and sacrifices in their lives But sometimes the 2% of our character that really needs to change, we defend to our last breath. To step onto the Sufi path is to commit oneself irrevocably to transformation, to say, yes, God, I am here. So we like to mix a little wrath with the mercy, you know, a little stringency with the gentleness, to keep some perspective on the truth. So forgive me if I've offended anyone. I don't think I have. The third maqam, the nafs al-muhamma, the one who is inspired as to the positive and the negative, the useful and the useless, the healthy and the unhealthy in our souls. Now, there are zikrs for these three levels, traditionally, in some of the tariqas, it's not universal, but the zikrs for these three maqams are first, La ilaha illallah for the first maqam, Allah for the second, and Hu for the third. And that's what we did together, procession. We went through these three levels. Thank you so much. We went through these three levels in order to come to a certain platform, shall we say, a certain state. In our own tariqah, when we give a zikr, and I'm happy to tell you this and share this with you, when we give a zikr to a novice, a new person entering the path, the typical Mevlevi zikr is first Fatiha, then Astaghfirullah, may God forgive me, a certain number of times, and then 100 La ilaha illallah, 100 Allah, and 300 Hu. And this covers those first three levels. There are levels above this, of course. As we begin to move from nafs al-mulhamma to nafs al-mutmainna, the self that is at peace, the self that is tranquil, the self that is tranquil because it remembers God. In the Quran, one of the most beautiful verses, one of the key verses of the Quran is, "Illa bi dhikrullah tutmain kulub." Indeed, in the remembrance of God, hearts find rest. And this tutmain is mutmaina, the tranquil self. It is the stage, really, of the true stage of the tariqah. These first three stages really cover the achieving an integrated self that has reached a modicum of goodness and balance and well-being. An ordinary religion, frankly, can usually take you this far if you're sincere.